better harness the support of partners to massively accelerate the journey. And even though their full aspiration isn't yet reached, that clarity of purpose enabled them to make a far greater contribution than they could have made under any other circumstances. This is the kind of statement of purpose that we need for our companies, teams, and careers. So how do we craft a statement of purpose that is both concrete and inspiring, meaningful and memorable? Stop wordsmithing and start deciding. When developing statements of purpose for your company, your team, or even yourself, there is a tendency to start obsessing about trivial stylistic details like, should we use this word or that word? But this makes it all too easy to slip into meaningless clichés and buzzwords that lead to vague, meaningless statements like the ones I cited at the beginning of the chapter. An essential intent doesn't have to be elegantly crafted. It's the substance, not the style, that counts. Instead, ask the more essential question that will inform every future decision you will ever make. If we could be truly excellent at only one thing, what would it be? Ask, how will we know when we're done? That said, when it comes to achieving clarity of purpose, inspiration does matter. When we think of inspiration, we often think of lofty rhetoric. But while rhetoric can certainly inspire, we need to remember that concrete objectives have the power to elevate and inspire as well. A powerful essential intent inspires people partially because it is concrete enough to answer the question, how will we know when we have succeeded? This was illustrated brilliantly to me by Professor Bill Meehan, who spent 30 years with McKinsey advising CEOs and senior leaders on strategy and now teaches a class called The Strategic Management of Nonprofits at the Stanford School of Business. When I took his course as a graduate student, one of the assignments he gave us was to evaluate the vision and mission statements of nonprofit organizations. As the class reviewed more than 100 examples, they noticed that some of the most grandiose were actually the least inspiring. For example, one had the mission to eliminate hunger in the world. But given that there were just 5 people in the organization, the mission felt like little more than empty words. Then, out of the cluttered landscape of such loose idealism, came a statement we all immediately understood and were inspired by. It was from a slightly unexpected place. The actor, social entrepreneur Brad Pitt, who, appalled by the lack of progress in rebuilding New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, had started an organization called Make It Right, with the essential intent to build 150 affordable, green, storm-resistant homes for families living in the lower Ninth Ward. That statement took the air out of the room. The concreteness of the objective made it real. The realness made it inspiring. It answered the question, how will we know when we have succeeded? Living with intent. Essential intent applies to so much more than your job description or your company's mission statement. A true essential intent is one that guides your greater sense of purpose and helps you chart your life's path. For example, Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in jail becoming an essentialist. When he was thrown in jail in 1962, he had almost everything taken from him. His home, his reputation, his pride, and of course his freedom. He chose to use those 27 years to focus on what was really essential and eliminate everything else, including his own resentment. He made it his essential intent to eliminate apartheid in South Africa, and in doing so established a legacy that lives on today. Creating an essential intent is hard. It takes courage, insight, and foresight to see which activities and efforts will add up to your single highest point of contribution. It takes asking tough questions, making real trade-offs, and exercising serious discipline to cut out the competing priorities that distract us from our true intention. Yet it is worth the effort because only with real clarity of purpose can people, teams, and organizations fully mobilize and achieve something truly excellent. Chapter 11. Dare. The power of a graceful no. Courage is grace under pressure. Ernest Hemingway. The right no, spoken at the right time, can change the course of history. In just one example of many, Rosa Parks' quiet but resolute refusal to give up her seat on a segregated Montgomery bus at exactly the right moment coalesced into forces that propelled the civil rights movement. As Parks recalls, "When the bus driver saw me still sitting, he asked if I was going to stand up, and I said, 'No, I'm not.'" Contrary to popular belief, her courageous no did not grow out of a particularly assertive tendency or personality in general. In fact, when she was made a secretary to the president of the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP, she explained, "I was the only woman there, and they needed a secretary, and I was too timid to say no." Rather, her decision on the bus grew out of a deep conviction about what deliberate choice she wanted to make in that moment. When the bus driver ordered her out of her seat, she said, "I felt a determination cover my body like a quilt on a winter night." She did not know how her decision would spark a movement with reverberations around the world, but she did know her own mind. She knew, even as she was being arrested, that it was the very last time that I would ever ride in humiliation of this kind. Avoiding that humiliation was worth the risk of incarceration. Indeed, to her, it was essential. It is true that we are, hopefully, unlikely to find ourselves facing a situation like the one faced by Rosa Parks. Yet we can be inspired by her. We can think of her when we need the courage to dare to say no. We can remember her strength of conviction when we need to stand our ground in the face of social pressure to capitulate to the non-essential. Have you ever felt a tension between what you felt was right and what someone was pressuring you to do? Have you ever felt the conflict between your internal conviction and an external action? Have you ever said yes when you meant no simply to avoid conflict or friction? Have you ever felt too scared or timid to turn down an invitation or request from a boss, colleague, friend, neighbor, or family member for fear of disappointing them? If you have, you're not alone. Navigating these moments with courage and grace is one of the most important skills to master in becoming an essentialist, and one of the hardest. I did not set out to write a chapter about courage, but the deeper I've looked at the subject of essentialism, the more clearly I have seen courage as key to the process of elimination. Without courage, the disciplined pursuit of less is just lip service. It is just the stuff of one more dinner party conversation. It is skin deep. Anyone can talk about the importance of focusing on the things that matter most, and many people do. But to see people who dare to live it is rare. I say this without judgment. We have good reasons to fear saying no. We worry we'll miss out on a great opportunity. We're scared of rocking the boat, stirring things up, burning bridges. We can't bear the thought of disappointing someone we respect and like. None of this makes us a bad person. It's a natural part of being human. Yet as hard as it can be to say no to someone, failing to do so can cause us to miss out on something far more important. A woman named Cynthia once told me a story about the time her father had made plans to take her on a night out in San Francisco. 12-year-old Cynthia and her father had been planning the date for months. They had a whole itinerary planned down to the minute. She would attend the last hour of his presentation and then meet him at the back of the room at about 4:30, and leave quickly before everyone tried to talk to him. They would catch a trolley car to Chinatown, eat Chinese food, their favorite, shop for a souvenir, see the sights for a while, and then catch a flick, as her dad liked to say. Then they would grab a taxi back to the hotel, jump in the pool for a quick swim — her dad was famous for sneaking in when the pool was closed — order a hot fudge sundae from room service, and watch the Late Late Show. They discussed the details over and over before they left. The anticipation was part of the whole experience. This was all going according to plan until, as her father was leaving the convention center, he ran into an old college friend and business associate. It had been years since they had seen each other, and Cynthia watched as they embraced enthusiastically. His friend said, in effect, "I am so glad you are doing some work with our company now. When Lois and I heard about it, we thought it would be perfect. We want to invite you and, of course, Cynthia, to get a spectacular seafood dinner down at the wharf." Cynthia's father responded, "Bob, it's so great to see you. Dinner at the wharf sounds great. Cynthia was crestfallen. Her daydreams of trolley rides and ice cream sundaes evaporated in an instant. Plus, she hated seafood, and she could just imagine how bored she would be listening to the adults talk all night. But then her father continued, "But not tonight. Cynthia and I have a special date planned, don't we?" He winked at Cynthia and grabbed her hand, and they ran out of the door and continued with what was an unforgettable night in San Francisco. As it happens, Cynthia's father was the management thinker Stephen R. Covey, author of The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, who had passed away only weeks before Cynthia told me this story. So it was with deep emotion she recalled that evening in San Francisco. His simple decision bonded him to me forever because I knew what mattered most to him was me, she said. Stephen R. Covey, one of the most respected and widely read business thinkers of his generation, was an essentialist. Not only did he routinely teach essentialist principles like the main thing is to keep the main thing, to important leaders and heads of state around the world, he lived them. And in this moment of living them with his daughter, he made a memory that literally outlasted his lifetime. Seen with some perspective, his decision seems obvious. But many in his shoes would have accepted the friend's invitation for fear of seeming rude or ungrateful, or passing up a rare opportunity to dine with an old friend. So why is it so hard in the moment to dare to choose what is essential over what is non-essential? One simple answer is we are unclear about what is essential. When this happens, we become defenseless. On the other hand, when we have strong internal clarity, it is almost as if we have a force field protecting us from the non-essentials coming at us from all directions. With Rosa, it was her deep moral clarity that gave her unusual courage of conviction. With Stephen, it was the clarity of his vision for the evening with his loving daughter. In virtually every instance, clarity about what is essential fuels us with the strength to say no to the non-essentials. Essentially awkward. A second reason why it is hard to choose what is essential in the moment is as simple as an innate fear of social awkwardness. The fact is, we as humans are wired to want to get along with others. After all, thousands of years ago, when we all lived in tribes of hunter-gatherers, our survival depended on it. And while conforming to what people in a group expect of us, what psychologists call normative conformity, is no longer a matter of life and death, the desire is still deeply ingrained in us. This is why, whether it's an old friend who invites you to dinner, or a boss who asks you to take on an important high-profile project, or a neighbor who begs you to help with the PTA bake sale, the very thought of saying no literally brings us physical discomfort. We feel guilty. We don't want to let someone down. We are worried about damaging the relationship. But these emotions muddle our clarity. They distract us from the reality of the fact that either we can say no and regret it for a few minutes, or we can say yes and regret it for days, weeks, months, or even years. The only way out of this trap is to learn to say no firmly, resolutely, and yet gracefully. Because once we do, we find not only that our fears of disappointing or angering others were exaggerated, but that people actually respect us more. Since becoming an essentialist, I have found it almost universally true that people respect and admire those with the courage of conviction to say no. Peter Drucker, in my view the father of modern management thinking, was also a master of the art of the graceful no. When Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, the Hungarian professor most well known for his work on flow, reached out to interview a series of creative individuals for a book he was writing on creativity, Drucker's response was interesting enough to Mihai that he quoted it verbatim. "I am greatly honored and flattered by your kind letter of February 14th, for I have admired you and your work for many years, and I have learned much from it. But my dear Professor Csikszentmihalyi, I am afraid I have to disappoint you. I could not possibly answer your questions. I am told I am creative. I don't know what that means. I just keep on plodding. I hope you will not think me presumptuous or rude if I say that one of the secrets of productivity, in which I believe, whereas I do not believe in creativity, is to have a very big waste paper basket to take care of all invitations such as yours. Productivity, in my experience, consists of not doing anything that helps the work of other people but to spend all one's time on the work the good Lord has fitted one to do, and to do well. A true essentialist, Peter Drucker believed that people are effective because they say no. Non-essentialists say yes because of feelings of social awkwardness and pressure. They say yes automatically, without thinking, often in pursuit of the rush one gets from having pleased someone. But essentialists know that after the rush comes the pang of regret. They know they will soon feel bullied and resentful, both at the other person and at themselves. Eventually, they will wake up to the unpleasant reality that something more important must now be sacrificed to accommodate this new commitment. Of course, the point is not to say no to all requests. The point is to say no to the non-essentials so we can say yes to the things that really matter. It is to say no, frequently and gracefully, to everything but what is truly vital. A non-essentialist avoids saying no to avoid feeling social awkwardness and pressure. An essentialist dares to say no firmly, resolutely, and gracefully. A non-essentialist says yes to everything. An essentialist says yes only to the things that really matter. So how do we learn to say no gracefully? Below are general guidelines followed by a number of specific scripts for delivering the graceful no. Separate the decision from the relationship. When people ask us to do something, we can confuse the request with our relationship with them. Sometimes they seem so interconnected, we forget that denying the request is not the same as denying the person. Only once we separate the decision from the relationship can we make a clear decision and then separately find the courage and compassion to communicate it. Saying no gracefully doesn't have to mean using the word no. Essentialists choose no more often than they say no. There may be a time when the most graceful way to say no is to simply say a blunt no. But whether it's, I am flattered that you thought of me, but I'm afraid I don't have the bandwidth, or I would very much like to, but I'm overcommitted, there are a variety of ways of refusing someone clearly and politely without actually using the word no. Later in the chapter, you'll find more examples of ways to gracefully word your no. Focus on the trade-off. The more we think about what we are giving up when we say yes to someone, the easier it is to say no. If we have no clear sense of the opportunity cost, in other words, the value of what we are giving up, then it is especially easy to fall into the non-essential trap of telling ourselves we can get it all done. We can't. A graceful no grows out of a clear but unstated calculation of the trade-off. Remind yourself that everyone is selling something. This doesn't mean you have to be cynical about people. I don't mean to imply people shouldn't be trusted. I am simply saying everyone is selling something, an idea, a viewpoint, an opinion, in exchange for your time. Simply being aware of what is being sold allows us to be more deliberate in deciding whether we want to buy it. Make your peace with the fact that saying no often requires trading popularity for respect. When you say no, there is usually a short-term impact on the relationship. After all, when someone asks for something and doesn't get it, his or her immediate reaction may be annoyance or disappointment, or even anger. This downside is clear. The potential upside, however, is less obvious. When the initial annoyance or disappointment or anger wears off, the respect kicks in. When we push back effectively, it shows people that our time is highly valuable. It distinguishes the professional from the amateur. A case in point is the time that graphic designer Paul Rand had the guts to say no to Steve Jobs. When Jobs was looking for a logo for the company Next, he asked Rand, whose work included the logos for IBM, UPS, Enron, Westinghouse, and ABC, to come up with a few options. But Rand didn't want to come up with a few options. He wanted to design just one option. So Rand said, "No, I will solve your problem for you, and you will pay me. And you don't have to use the solution. If you want options, go talk to other people. But I will solve the problem the best way I know how. And you use it or not, that's up to you." Not surprisingly, Rand solved the problem and created the dual logo Jobs wanted. But the real lesson here is the effect Rand's pushback had on Jobs, who later said of Rand, "He is one of the most professional people I have ever worked with," in the sense that he had thought through all of the formal relationship between a client and a professional such as himself. Rand took a risk when he said no. He bet a short-term popularity loss for a long-term gain in respect, and it paid off. Essentialists accept they cannot be popular with everyone all of the time. Yes, saying no respectfully, reasonably, and gracefully can come at a short-term social cost, but part of living the way of the essentialist is realizing respect is far more valuable than popularity in the long run. Remember that a clear no can be more graceful than a vague or non-committal yes. As anyone who has ever been on the receiving end of this situation knows, a clear, "I am going to pass on this," is far better than not getting back to someone or stringing them along with some non-committal answer like, "I will try to make this work," or, "I might be able to," when you know you can't. Being vague is not the same as being graceful, and delaying the eventual no will only make it that much harder, and the recipient that much more resentful. The no repertoire. Remember, essentialists don't say no just occasionally. It is a part of their regular repertoire. To consistently say no with grace, then, it helps to have a variety of responses to call upon. Following are 8 responses you can put in your no repertoire. 1. The awkward pause. Instead of being controlled by the threat of an awkward silence, own it. Use it as a tool. When a request comes to you, obviously this works only in person, just pause for a moment. Count to 3 before delivering your verdict. Or, if you get a bit more bold, simply wait for the other person to fill the void. 2. The soft no, or the no but. I recently received an email inviting me to coffee. I replied, "I am consumed with writing my book right now," smiley face. "But I would love to get together once the book is finished. Let me know if we can get together towards the end of the summer." Email is also a good way to start practicing saying no but, because it gives you the chance to draft and redraft your no to make it as graceful as possible. Plus, many people find that the distance of email reduces the fear of awkwardness. 3. Let me check my calendar and get back to you. One leader I know found her time being hijacked by other people all day. A classic non-essentialist, she was capable and smart and unable to say no. And as a result, she soon became a go-to person. People would run up to her and say, "Could you help with X project?" Meaning to be a good citizen, she said yes. But soon she felt burdened with all of these different agendas. Things changed for her when she learned to use a new phrase. "Let me check my calendar and get back to you." It gave her the time to pause and reflect and ultimately reply that she was regretfully unavailable. It enabled her to take back control of her own decisions rather than be rushed into a yes when she was asked. 4. Use email bounce backs. It is totally natural and expected to get an auto response when someone is traveling or out of the office. Really, this is the most socially acceptable no there is. People aren't saying they don't want to reply to your email. They're just saying they can't get back to you for a period of time. So why limit these to vacations and holidays? When I was writing this book, I set an email bounce back with the subject line, "In monk mode." The email said, "Dear friends, I am currently working on a new book which has put enormous burdens on my time. Unfortunately, I am unable to respond in the manner I would like. For this, I apologize. Greg." And guess what? People seem to adapt to my temporary absence and non-responsiveness just fine. 5. Say, "Yes, what should I deprioritize?" Saying no to a senior leader at work is almost unthinkable, even laughable, for many people. However, when saying yes is going to compromise your ability to make the highest level of contribution to your work, it is also your obligation. In this case, it is not only reasonable to say no, it is essential. One effective way to do that is to remind your superiors, what you would be neglecting if you said yes and forced them to grapple with the trade-off. For example, if your manager comes to you and asks you to do X, you can respond with, "Yes, I'm happy to make this the priority. Which of these other projects should I deprioritize to pay attention to this new project?" Or simply say, "I would want to do a great job, and given my other commitments, I wouldn't be able to do a job I was proud of if I took this on." I know a leader who received this response from a subordinate. There was no way he wanted to be responsible for disrupting this productive and organized employee. So he took the non-essential work project back and gave it to someone else who was less organized. 6. Say it with humor. I recently was asked by a friend to join him in training for a marathon. My response was simple, "Nope." He laughed a little and said, "Ah, you practice what you preach." Just goes to show how useful it is to have a reputation as an essentialist. 7. Use the words, "You are welcome to X, I am willing to Y." For example, "You are welcome to borrow my car, I am willing to make sure the keys are here for you." By this, you are also saying, "I won't be able to drive you." You are saying what you will not do, but you are couching it in terms of what you are willing to do. This is a particularly good way to navigate a request you would like to support somewhat, but cannot throw your full weight behind. I particularly like this construct because it also expresses a respect for the other person's ability to choose, as well as your own. It reminds both parties of the choices they have. 8. I can't do it, but X might be interested. It is tempting to think that our help is uniquely invaluable, but often people requesting something don't really care if we're the ones who help them, as long as they get the help. Kay Krill, the CEO of Ann Inc., aka Ann Taylor, and Loft Women's Clothing Retailers, used to have a terrible time saying no to social invitations. As a result, she would end up at networking events she had no interest in attending. She would find herself going to office parties and regretting it the moment she got there. Then one day, one of her mentors came to her and told her that she had to learn to jettison the people and things of her life that just didn't matter, and that doing so would allow her to put 100% of her energy into the things that had meaning for her. That advice liberated her. Now she is able to pick and choose. With practice, politely declining an invitation has become easy for her. Kay explains, "I say no very easily because I know what is important to me. I only wish that I learned how to do that earlier in my life." Saying no is its own leadership capability. It is not just a peripheral skill. As with any ability, we start with limited experience. We are novices at no. Then we learn a couple of basic techniques. We make mistakes. We learn from them. We develop more skills. We keep practicing. After a while, we have a whole repertoire available at our disposal, and in time we have gained mastery of a type of social art form. We can handle almost any request from almost anybody with grace and dignity. Tom Friel, the former CEO of Heidrick & Struggles, once said to me, "We need to learn the slow yes and the quick no." Chapter 12. Uncommit. Win big by cutting your losses. Half of the troubles of this life can be traced to saying yes too quickly and not saying no soon enough. Josh Billings. By any estimation, the Concorde jet was a striking achievement in aeronautical engineering. Aboard this passenger plane, you could fly from London to New York in as little as 2 hours, 52 minutes, and 59 seconds. That's less than half the time of a traditional plane, making the Concorde the fastest passenger plane in the world. Unfortunately, it was also an extraordinary financial failure. Of course, many great ideas, innovations, and products are. But what made this one different was that it consistently lost money for more than 4 decades. Yet each time it went over budget, the French and British governments poured more and more money in. They did this even knowing that the chance of recouping their continued investments let alone the original expenditures, were minuscule. With the plane's limited seating, few orders coming in, and the high cost of production, it was clear that even with exaggerated estimates, the project would never be profitable. Indeed, when the British cabinet papers were released under the 30-year rule, they revealed that government ministers at the time knew the investment could not stand on normal economic grounds. Why would intelligent, capable British and French government officials continue to invest in what was clearly a losing proposition for so long? One reason is a very common psychological phenomenon called sunk cost bias. Sunk cost bias is the tendency to continue to invest time, money, or energy into something we know is a losing proposition simply because we have already incurred, or sunk, a cost that cannot be recouped. But of course, this can easily become a vicious cycle. The more we invest, the more determined we become to see it through and see our investment pay off. The more we invest in something, the harder it is to let go. The sunk costs for developing and building the Concorde were around $1 billion. Yet the more money the British and French governments poured into it, the harder it was to walk away. Individuals are equally vulnerable to sunk cost bias. It explains why we'll continue to sit through a terrible movie, because we've already paid the price of a ticket. It explains why we continue to pour money into a home renovation that never seems to near completion. It explains why we'll continue to wait for a bus or a subway train that never comes instead of hailing a cab. And it explains why we invest in toxic relationships even when our efforts only make things worse. Examples like this abound. Consider the somewhat bizarre story of a man named Henry Gribbum, who recently spent his entire life savings, $2,600 in total, at a carnival game trying to win an oversized banana. The more he spent, the more determined he became to win. Henry said, "You just get caught up in the whole, I've got to win my money back." But it didn't turn out that way. The more he invested in trying to win this utterly non-essential item, the harder it was for him to walk away. Have you ever continued to invest time or effort in a non-essential project instead of cutting your losses? Have you ever continued to pour money into an investment that wasn't panning out instead of walking away? Have you ever kept plodding down a dead end because you could not admit, "I shouldn't have pursued this direction in the first place"? Ever been stuck in a cycle of throwing good money after bad? A non-essentialist can't break free of traps like these. An essentialist has the courage and confidence to admit his or her mistakes and uncommit, no matter the sunk costs. A non-essentialist asks, "Why stop now when I've already invested so much in this project?" An essentialist asks, "If I weren't already invested in this project, how much would I invest in it now?" A non-essentialist thinks, "If I just keep trying, I can make this work." An essentialist thinks, "What else could I do with this time or money if I pulled the plug now?" A non-essentialist hates admitting to mistakes. An essentialist is comfortable with cutting losses. Sunk cost bias, while all too common, isn't the only non-essentialist trap to watch out for. Below are several other common traps and tips for how to extricate yourself politely, gracefully, and with minimal cost. Avoiding commitment traps. Beware of the endowment effect. A sense of ownership is a powerful thing. As the saying goes, nobody in the history of the world has washed their rental car. This is because of something called the endowment effect. Our tendency to undervalue things that aren't ours and to overvalue things because we already own them. In one study demonstrating the power of the endowment effect, the Nobel Prize-winning researcher Daniel Kahneman and colleagues randomly gave coffee mugs to only half the subjects in an experiment. The first group was asked how much they would be willing to sell their mug for, while the second group was asked what they would be willing to pay for it. It turned out that the students who owned the mugs refused to sell for less than $5.25, while those without the cups were willing to pay only $2.25 to $2.75. The mere fact of ownership, in other words, caused the mug owners to value the objects more highly and made them less willing to part with them. In your own life, I'm sure you can think of items that seem to be more valuable the moment you think about giving them away. Think of a book on your shelf you haven't read in years, or a kitchen appliance still sitting in the box, or the sweater you got from Aunt Mildred but never wore. Whether or not you get any use or enjoyment out of them, subconsciously, the very fact that they are yours makes you value them more highly than you would if they didn't belong to you. Unfortunately, we have this bias when it comes to non-essential activities as well as belongings. The project that isn't getting anywhere at work seems that much more critical when we're the team leader on it. The commitment to volunteer at the local bake sale becomes harder to get out of when we're the one who put the fundraiser together. When we feel we own an activity, it becomes harder to uncommit. Nonetheless, here is a useful tip. Pretend you don't own it yet. Tom Stafford describes a simple antidote to the endowment effect. Instead of asking, how much do I value this item, we should ask, if I did not own this item, how much would I pay to obtain it? We can do the same for opportunities and commitment. Don't ask, how will I feel if I miss out on this opportunity, but rather, if I did not have this opportunity, how much would I be willing to sacrifice in order to obtain it? Similarly, we can ask, if I wasn't already involved in this project, how hard would I work to get on it? Get over the fear of waste. Hal Arks, a professor of psychology at Ohio State University who studies judgment in decision-making, was puzzled by an enigma. Why are adults so much more vulnerable to the sunk cost bias than young children? The answer, he believes, a lifetime to exposure to the don't waste rule, so that by the time we are adults, we are trained to avoid appearing wasteful, even to ourselves. Abandoning a project that you've invested a lot in feels like you've wasted everything, and waste is something we're told to avoid, Ark said. To illustrate this, he gave the following scenario to a group of participants. Assume that you have spent $100 on a ticket for a weekend ski trip to Michigan. Several weeks later, you buy a $50 ticket for a weekend ski trip to Wisconsin. You think you will enjoy the Wisconsin ski trip more than the Michigan ski trip. As you are putting your newly purchased Wisconsin ticket in your wallet, you notice that the Michigan ski trip and the Wisconsin ski trip are for the same weekend. It's too late to sell or return either ticket. You must choose which to use. When asked which ski trip will you go on, more than half said they would opt for the more expensive trip, even though they would enjoy it less. Their faulty reasoning was that using the cheaper ticket would be wasting more money than using the expensive ticket. It's natural not to want to let go of what we wasted on a bad choice. But when we don't, we doom ourselves to keep wasting even more. Instead, admit failure to begin success. I remember a friend who would never stop to ask for directions because he could never admit he was lost. So we would waste time and energy driving around in circles getting nowhere, the epitome of a non-essential activity. Only when we admit we have made a mistake in committing to something can we make a mistake a part of our past. When we remain in denial, on the other hand, we continue to circle pointlessly. There should be no shame in admitting to a mistake. After all, we really are only admitting that we are now wiser than we once were. Stop trying to force a fit. In the movie Tootsie, Dustin Hoffman plays a struggling actor who is trying to get work. The movie begins comically with a series of failed auditions. At one he is told, we need someone a little older. At the next he is told, we're looking for someone younger. Then at the next, you're the wrong height. To which he responds, I can be taller. The executive responds, no, we're looking for somebody shorter. Desperate to make it work, Hoffman's character explains, look, I don't have to be this tall, see, I'm wearing lifts, I can be shorter. But the executive also insists, I know, but we're looking for somebody different. Still persistent, the would-be actor pushes back again, I can be different. The point is that we often act like Dustin Hoffman's character by trying too hard to be something we're not. Whether in our personal or professional lives, it is all too tempting to force something that is simply a mismatch. The solution? Get a neutral second opinion. When we get so emotionally hung up on trying to force something that is not the right fit, we can often benefit from a sounding board. Someone who is not emotionally involved in the situation and unaffected by the choice we make can give us the permission to stop forcing something that is clearly not working out. I once wasted months of effort trying to force a project that just wasn't working out. Looking back, the more I put into it, the worse things became. But my irrational response was to invest still more. I thought, I can make this work. I did not want to accept I had been wasting my effort. I finally shared my frustration with a friend who had the advantage of being emotionally removed from the project, someone who wasn't burdened with the sunk costs and could evaluate my decisions with some perspective. After listening to me, he said, "You're not married to this." And with those simple words, I was liberated to stop investing in a non-essential. Be aware of the status quo bias. The tendency to continue doing something simply because we have always done it is sometimes called the status quo bias. I once worked at a company that used an employee evaluation system that seemed to me so woefully outdated that I became curious about how long it had been in place. As I searched for its creator in the company, I found that nobody, up to and including the long-standing head of HR, knew of its origin. More shocking still, in the 10 years she had been at the company, nobody had once questioned the system. It's all too easy to blindly accept and not bother to question commitments simply because they have already been established. One cure for the status quo bias is borrowed from the world of accounting. Apply zero-based budgeting. Typically, when accountants allocate a budget, they use last year's budget as the baseline for the next year's projection. But with zero-based budgeting, they use zero as the baseline. In other words, every item in the proposed budget must be justified from scratch. While this takes more effort, it has many advantages. It efficiently allocates resources on the basis of needs rather than history. It detects exaggerated budget requests. It draws attention to obsolete operations, and it encourages people to be clearer in their purpose and how their expenses align to that project. You can apply zero-based budgeting to your own endeavors. Instead of trying to budget your time on the basis of existing commitments, assume that all bets are off. All previous commitments are gone. Then begin from scratch, asking which you would add today. You can do this with everything from the financial obligations you have to projects you are committed to, even relationships you are in. Every use of time, energy, or resources has to justify itself anew. If it no longer fits, eliminate it altogether. Stop making casual commitments. Some people's days are full to the brim with soft commitments they have taken on unintentionally through an offhand comment or casual conversation they had somewhere with someone. You know the kind I mean. You're chatting with your neighbor about her work on the PTA, your colleague about a new initiative she is heading up, or your friend about a new restaurant he wants to try. And before you know it, boom, you're committed. From now on, pause before you speak. It might sound obvious, but pausing for just 5 seconds before offering your services can greatly reduce the possibility of making a commitment you'll regret. Before the words, "That sounds great, I'd love to," fly out of your mouth, ask yourself, is this essential? If you've already made a casual commitment you're regretting, find a nice way to worm your way out. Simply apologize and tell the person that when you made the commitment, you didn't fully realize what it would entail. Get over the fear of missing out. We've seen ample evidence in this chapter suggesting that the majority of us are naturally very loss averse. As a result, one of the obstacles to uncommitting ourselves from a present course is the fear of missing out on something great. To fight this fear, run a reverse pilot. One of the ideas that has grown popular in business circles in recent years is prototyping. Building a prototype or large-scale model allows companies to test run an idea or product without making a huge investment up front. Exactly the same idea can be used in reverse to eliminate non-essentials in a relatively low-risk way by running what Daniel Shapiro, a director at LinkedIn, calls a reverse pilot. In a reverse pilot, you test whether removing an initiative or activity will have any negative consequences. For example, when an executive I work with took on a new senior role in the company, he inherited a process his predecessor had gone to a huge effort to implement. A huge, highly visual report on a myriad of subjects produced for the other executives each week. It consumed enormous energy from his team, and he hypothesized that it was not adding a great deal of value to the company. So to test his hypothesis, he ran a reverse pilot. He simply stopped publishing the report and waited to see what the response would be. What he found was that no one seemed to miss it. After several weeks, nobody had even mentioned the report. As a result, he concluded that the report was not essential to the business and could be eliminated. A similar reverse pilot can be carried out in our social lives. Are there commitments you routinely make to customers, colleagues, friends, or even family members that you have always assumed made a big difference to them, but that, in fact, they might barely notice? By quietly eliminating or at least scaling back an activity for a few days or weeks, you might be able to assess whether it is really making a difference or whether no one really cares. Even using these techniques, it's true that uncommitting can be harder than simply not committing in the first place. We feel guilty saying no to something or someone we have already committed to. And let's face it, no one likes going back on their word. Yet learning how to do so in ways that will garner you respect for your courage, focus, and discipline is crucial to becoming an essentialist. Chapter 13. Edit. The Invisible Art. I saw the angel in the marble and carved until I set him free. Michelangelo. Every year at the Academy Awards, the most notable prize is for Best Picture. The media speculate on it for weeks prior to the broadcast, and most viewers stay up well past their bedtimes to see it awarded. There is a far less hyped award on the night, the one for film editing. Let's face it, most viewers flip the channel or go into the kitchen to refill their popcorn bowl when the winner of Best Film Editing is announced. Yet what most people don't know is that the two awards are highly correlated. Since 1981, not a single film has won Best Picture without at least being nominated for film editing. In fact, in about two-thirds of the cases, the movie nominated for film editing has gone on to win Best Picture. In the history of the Academy Awards, the most respected, if not exactly celebrated, film editor is Michael Caine. With 8 nominations, more than anyone else in the business, and 3 wins under his belt. While his is hardly a household name, the films he has edited certainly are. He is the editor of such notable films as Saving Private Ryan, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Schindler's List, and Lincoln. Indeed, over 37 years he has edited almost all of Steven Spielberg's movies, becoming his right-hand man in the process. Yet only a handful of people know Caine's name. It is for good reason that film editing is sometimes known as the invisible art. Clearly, editing, which involves the strict elimination of the trivial, unimportant, or irrelevant, is an essentialist craft. So what makes a good editor? When the editing branch of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences sit down to select their nominees for film editing, they try, as Mark Harris has written, very hard not to look at what they're supposed to be looking at. In other words, a good film editor makes it hard not to see what's important because she eliminates everything but the elements that absolutely need to be there. In Chapter 6, we likened exploring to being a journalist. It involves asking questions, listening, and connecting the dots in order to distinguish the essential few from the trivial many. So it makes sense that the next stage in the essentialist process, eliminating the non-essentials, means taking on the role of an editor in your life and leadership. Jack Dorsey is best known as the creator of Twitter and as the founder and CEO of Square, a mobile payments company. His essentialist approach to management is a relatively rare one. At a dinner I attended recently where he spoke, he said he thinks of the role of CEO as being the chief editor of the company. At another event at Stanford, he explained further, "By editorial, I mean there are 1,000 things we could be doing, but there are only 1 or 2 that are important. And all of these ideas and inputs from engineers, support people, designers, are going to constantly flood what we should be doing. As an editor, I am constantly taking these inputs and deciding the one, or intersection of a few, that makes sense for what we are doing." An editor is not merely someone who says no to things. A 3-year-old can do that. Nor does an editor simply eliminate. In fact, in a way, an editor actually adds. What I mean is that a good editor is someone who uses deliberate subtraction to actually add life to the ideas, setting, plot, and characters. Likewise in life, disciplined editing can help add to your level of contribution. It increases your ability to focus on and give energy to the things that really matter. It lends the most meaningful relationships and activities more space to blossom. Editing aids the effortless execution of the essentialist by removing anything distracting or unnecessary or awkward. Or as one book editor put it, "My job is to make life as effortless as possible for the reader. The goal is to help the reader have the clearest possible understanding of the most important message or takeaway." Of course, editing also involves making trade-offs. Instead of trying to fit it all in, every character, every plot twist, every detail, an editor asks, "Will this character or plot twist or detail make it better?" For an author, whether of films, books, or journalism, it is easy to get overly committed to a certain idea or body of work, especially one you slaved over. It can be quite painful to eliminate passages, pages, or even chapters that took weeks, months, maybe even years to write in the first place. Yet such disciplined elimination is critical to the craft. You must, as Stephen King has said, kill your darlings, even when it breaks your egocentric little scribbler's heart, kill your darlings. A non-essentialist thinks that making things better means adding something. An essentialist thinks that making things better means subtracting something. A non-essentialist is attached to every word, image, or detail. An essentialist eliminates the distracting words, images, and details. Of course, editing a film or a book or any other creative work is not the same as editing your life. In life, we don't have the luxury of revisiting a conversation we have just had, or a meeting we just led, or a presentation we just made and reworking it, red pen in hand. Nevertheless, 4 simple principles inherent in editing do apply to editing the non-essentials out of our lives. Editing life. Cut out options. To state the obvious, editing involves cutting out things that confuse the reader and cloud the message or story. It is a matter of record that well-edited movies and books are easy on the eye and the brain. When making decisions, deciding to cut options can be terrifying, but the truth is, it is the very essence of decision-making. In fact, the Latin root of the word decision, cis or sid, literally means to cut or to kill. You can see this in words like scissors, homicide, or fratricide. Since ultimately having fewer options actually makes a decision easier on the eye and the brain, we must summon the discipline to get rid of options or activities that may be good, or even really good, but that get in the way. Yes, making the choice to eliminate something good can be painful. But eventually, every cut produces joy. Maybe not in the moment, but afterwards, when we realize that every additional moment we have gained can be spent on something better. That may be one reason why Stephen King has written, "To write is human, to edit is divine." Condense. Many people have been credited with coming up with this apt sentiment. "I must apologize, If I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. It's true that doing less can be harder, both in art and in life. Every word, every scene, every activity must count for more. An editor is ruthless in the pursuit of making every word count. Instead of saying it in two sentences, can you say it in one? Is it possible to use one word where two are currently being used? As Alan D. Williams observed in the essay, What is an Editor? There are two basic questions the editor should be addressing to the author. Are you saying what you want to say? And are you saying it as clearly and concisely as possible? Condensing means saying it as clearly and concisely as possible. Likewise, in life, condensing allows us to do more with less. For example, when Graham Hill moved into a 420-square-foot apartment in New York, he wanted to see how well he could condense everything he owned. The ultimate result was a design he called a little jewel box. The jewel box works because every piece of furniture has multiple functions. The wall on the left of the picture, for example, acts as a large projector screen for watching movies and also houses two guest beds that can be pulled out when visitors come to stay. The wall to the right folds down over the couch to reveal a queen bed. Everything does double or triple duty. In other words, everything makes a greater contribution to apartment life. This design turned out to be so innovative that he turned it into a business devoted to the art of getting more out of less space. He named it appropriately lifeedited.com. But to be clear, condensing doesn't mean doing more at once. It simply means less waste. It means lowering the ratio of words to ideas, square feet to usefulness, or effort to results. Thus, to apply the principle of condensing to our lives, we need to shift the ratio of activities to meaning. We need to eliminate multiple meaningless activities and replace them with one very meaningful activity. For example, one employee at a company I've worked with, one who was well enough established to not have to worry about being fired, routinely skipped the weekly meeting other people attended and would simply ask them what he had missed. Thus, he condensed a two-hour meeting into 10 minutes and invested the rest of that redeemed time getting the important work done. Correct. An editor's job is not just to cut or condense, but also to make something right. It can be a change as minor as a grammar correction or as involved as fixing the flaws in an argument. To do this well, an editor must have a clear sense of the overarching purpose of the work he or she is editing. As Michael Kahn explains, he doesn't always do what Spielberg tells him to do. Instead, he does what he thinks Spielberg really wants. Understanding the overarching intent allows him to make the corrections that even Spielberg himself might not be able to verbalize. Similarly, in our own professional or private lives, we can make course corrections by coming back to our core purpose. Having a clear overarching intent, as discussed in Chapter 10, enables us to check ourselves, to regularly compare our activities or behaviors to our real intent. If they are incorrect, we can edit them. Edit less. This may seem a little counterintuitive, but the best editors don't feel the need to change everything. They know that sometimes having the discipline to leave certain things exactly as they are is the best use of their editorial judgment. It is just one more way in which being an editor is an invisible craft. The best surgeon is not the one who makes the most incisions. Similarly, the best editors can sometimes be the least intrusive, the most restrained. Becoming an editor in our lives also includes knowing when to show restraint. One way we can do this is by editing our tendency to step in. When we are added onto an email thread, for example, we can resist our usual temptation to be the first to reply all. When sitting in a meeting, we can resist the urge to add our 2 cents. We can wait. We can observe. We can see how things develop. Doing less is not just a powerful essentialist strategy, it's a powerful editorial one as well. A non-essentialist views editing as a discrete task to be performed only when things become overwhelming. But waiting too long to edit will force us to make major cuts not always of our choosing. Editing our time and activities continuously allows us to make more minor but deliberate adjustments along the way, becoming an essential